Thank you very much, Marcel. Honored to be here. Let's see, this is not my slide. Yes, here I am. So in the next 20 minutes, I'm going to present to you the more interventional part and the more hope that Martin Blaser stopped with, and giving you an insight in what I think in the next 5 to 10 years is going to help our health and is going to also speed up basically our morbidity and mortality. I always start with the conclusions, and I'm going to tell you, I hope I'm going to convince you, that the microbiota in humans is not yet causal, in contrast to the animal work, but that using fecal transplants, which is, well, a lot of rather distasteful kind of topic just before dinner, we're going to discuss it because I think it's a very nice way to show causality. I will tell you that not all diseases are equal in terms of microbiota, and that some people with the same disease will respond to a microbiota intervention, others will not, and I end up with a happy hope of personalized interventions. So we have also something to celebrate. I'm not going to show you Mondrian, but a very famous Antony van Leeuwenhoek, who was in Leiden and Delft, and he was the first to describe these kleine diertjes. And they were living in his mouth, but also in the canals just in front of his house. And basically with the, let's see here, with this little microscope, he was able to see all of these little creatures in himself. And that's about 400 years ago. So that's a really long time since we now have said that these bacteria and fungi might play a role. Then this microbiome has been coined about 20 years ago when I was still in med school, when Joshua Lederberg said the microbiome is the animals that live inside, of the bacteria that live inside our mouth, but also our lungs and everywhere. They are about 2 kilograms for each person, so that's quite a lot, and we think it's about a couple of thousand bacteria that dwell in and on us. And these bacteria, as Marcel Levy just said, are equaling our amount of genome, so it's said that we are at least as much bacterial DNA as we are human DNA. Many of the bacteria differ from the upper part of the GI tract to the lower part of the GI tract, as you can imagine, because the function is different. These microbiota are, being an endocrinologist myself, are the most endocrine organ that we have. So they are, as Professor Blaser showed you, involved in taking up food particles, but they also produce from the food metabolites. And metabolites are little small pieces of our food that get into the bloodstream and might cause atherosclerosis or even Alzheimer's disease. They also produce vitamins, so we really need these bacteria, and they metabolize our drugs, and I will show you that in the next slide. But most importantly, they train our immune system and are also involved in autoimmune diseases. So the question, of course, is where are we standing in terms of what is a normal microbiota? Well, Siska Wemmingha is in the audience here, as far as I know. She led a very big cohort in Groningen, the Netherlands, where they looked in Caucasians, so people from really Dutch descent, what would be the role of the microbiota in terms of relation with disease, and how much can we explain of the microbiota differences between me and Marty Blaser in terms of microbiota. And they found that they could explain about 20% of our variation based on medication use, smoking, dietary factors, and the presence of a disease, which means that 80% of what is dwelling and differencing between us as peoples is not known. And that, I think, is the big enigma. So if we don't know what we're studying, how can we then start to target it in a therapeutic fashion? So these are the creatures that we're looking at. These are in our gut, feasting on food particles. We have these bacteria here, and you have these bacteria here. Millions and trillions of them inside our gut. So I think what Professor Blaser pointed out very well is that we have lots of information about an association between a disease and the difference in microbiota. So this is a thing that I borrowed from my dear friend Frederick Beckett, where he very basically showed that Alzheimer disease, asthma, just like Martin Blaser said, are associated with a different microbiota. But also food, whether we are exposed to cold, whether we're eating dietary-derived animal products or plant-based products, all associate with a different microbiota, and thus a different association with the disease, which is not causality. Others here in the audience, and Mihai Nitea and Joost Wierzig, have studied the role of these bacteria in our gut in relation to sepsis. So that's bacteria in our bloodstream that trigger the immune system, which you might end up after a surgery into the ICU. And they showed indeed associative that diseases like sepsis also have a different microbiota in the gut associated with these disease. We can take it even further and showing that organs that are associated with autoimmune diseases, thyroid disease, 1 out of 10 Dutch people have thyroid disease, but also type 1 diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, all are associated by an altered gut microbiota. And I think most important, these microbes talk to our body and talk to our brain. So what you see here in a very nice kind of figure is that we have both all kind of nerves that go from our brain to the gut and back, and these microbes tell these brains what to fire and what kind of message to convey to the brain back. And it should not surprise you that we have even more neurons in our gut than in our brain, telling us evolutionary that these neurons are there for a reason. And that brings me to my topic, because I am a researcher that would like to study obesity and try to do something about obesity in the world, but mostly the fact that people with obesity get diabetes. So we know, and Professor Blazer showed you that diabetes is on the rise. Diabetes is basically that we are obese and we get high blood sugars, and it's majorly driven by obesity. And as you can see, the Netherlands are still fine, but the US and Russia and especially India are much higher in people that have diabetes in the world. And you can say, what does that have to do with the brain? Well, probably a lot, because lifestyle and diet are driving this. And I'm not advocating here the American lifestyle, but we know that the diet of Americans is different and our lifestyle than what we have. And this might also be driven by the changes in the microbiota. So a little bit deeper into this, what diabetes is, before we'll go on to the causality question. Because diabetes is multifactorial. That's why we don't have a cure yet. Because if we know why people would have a high blood sugar, we would cure it, but we don't. We know that these people are usually obese. We know that they have an increased glucose level in their blood, a high blood pressure, and cholesterol, which is altered. But there are many things that are driving this. For example, genes, or exercise, or diet, and maybe the microbiota as well. And this is interesting because Hippocrates, the one whose doctors swear oath to when they get their license, he already said that all disease starts in the gut, including diabetes. So maybe these microbes play a role in terms of the disease. Now, the thing with the Dutch, and just like the US, is that we have a lot of diabetes, and we have a lot of people that will develop diabetes, but we also are a multicultural society, which means that about more than 50% of the inhabitants in the Netherlands or in Amsterdam are not Caucasian. They are coming from the old colonies, or they're coming from Africa, or they're coming from Morocco. And what you can see here is that people that are for African American descent have a different trajectory in their BMI increase, or their body mass index, than people who are from Hispanic or Caucasian descent. And Asian people have another trajectory. So this means that when we are seeing people in the outpatient clinic, we're saying you might be overweight. That doesn't mean that the same level of overweight, for example, BMI of 25, is also overweight for an African-American person who might have a BMI of 30 and then be overweight. So we have to go more personalized, and we studied that in more detail in Amsterdam, where we took this benefit of having a multi-ethnic population and looked with all these people that came from different parts of the world to Amsterdam whether their microbiota would be different. And we, of course, corrected for their diet, because different people from different ethnic descent have a different diet. But still, we would find that people from Morocco, compared to people from Suriname, South Asians, compared to people from the Netherlands, have a different microbiota. and they also have a different trajectory in diabetes, and they have a different trajectory in getting specific illnesses. So we added another thing to Siska Weimega's research, that we think that where you come from also might play a role in your disease risk. But this is still association. This is not causality. And I think the biggest example is that I showed you this picture of people walking the dog in a car. We exposing our family members and our pets also to our lifestyle, and that's why obese owners might have obese dogs and vice versa, the lean ones. And we're adding on this microbiota part because we know that people that are living in the same household have the same microbiota, but not only in their gut, but also in their tongue and on their skin. So we're exchanging, but what about causality? So Marty Blaser told you about animal models, which have brought us tremendous insight, but they are controlled. Mice you can put in a cage, they don't lie about their diet, which usually humans do, as I can vouch for. And they allow basically to study a whole animal. Whereas humans, they have a different age, as Professor Blaser showed you. When a disease starts, they usually don't recollect when they had antibiotic courses, and the phenotype is multifactorial. So what we're trying to solve causality with is Koch's postulates, something we all learn in third year med school or biology, who said, a very famous bacteriologist, Dr. Koch, that if we have, let's say, the flu around, some people are canceled because they had the flu, this is of course a virus, but it's the same example, you have specific trajectories that you follow whether you say that the flu virus is driving this flu. The first is that the people that I spread this flu around here, this virus, you will get sick. That's an association. The second is that I culture this virus or bacteria from a diseased person, I find the same bacteria back. And the third one is if I treat this bacteria or this virus, then the disease goes away. That is causality. And that's a tough cookie to crumble when we're talking about the microbiota. And the way we're trying to do this in the Netherlands is by fecal microbiota, which is, as distasteful as it is, we're giving the stool of one person to another. But be aware that this is very old. In the 4th century before Christ, in Chinese handbooks, it was already said that you could cure people with the stool of a baby from depression or from abdominal cramps. And then it was silent again, then we had the antibiotics, then the first surgeon in the US who did an FMT, and now we're here with a lot of FMTs done around the world, but especially here in Amsterdam for specific ranges of disease, including diabetes and cancer. So now I have to warn you, this is a disclaimer, the pictures might be a little bit filthy, but this is what it is. We bring in stool from another person, and we basically try to give the intestine a new wallpaper with bacteria. That is what we do. And of course, the future will be to give capsules, which is easier. But this is the whole trick. Now, I know that there's ethic people in the room, and I would really like to have a discussion with them on this, because when you are talking about stool, and this is so readily available, people start doing it themselves. And this is what you can have, is you go to YouTube, and you have a 30-minute tutorial about doing it yourself at home. And this is not a joke. I have many patients that are threatening if we don't give them a fecal transplant in the hospital, they're going to internet and are doing it themselves. And this brings out a huge ethical thing, because people can do it themselves, but we know that we have to screen these feces before we give it to patients, because we might make them sick. And this is indeed what happened. So some people got sick and even died from giving donor stool to other patients. A warning. A big warning that it's not as simple as it looks like, although it's ancient and although it has been around for a long time. Now, there's good initiatives also here in the Netherlands, and I don't know whether Ed Kuiper is in the room, but he made the news a year ago where he set up the Dutch Stool Bank initiative, which basically said, if you are healthy, bring us your stool, we'll screen you, and we'll store the stool for later to treat other people. And he made the news. But I also have to tell you that it's a very expensive hobby that he does, because only one out of 46 people, so that's about three of you here in the ward, in the room, are eligible, not ward, it's my too much doctor in me, sorry. It costs a lot of money to screen and to find the patients of the healthy donors for the patients. So how to get around it? And how to get around it is first to understand better what are we doing. So we, 10 years ago, had a very simple question, just in line with what Professor Blaser said. If the bacteria of an obese person are different than a lean subject, what happens if we give the stool from a lean person to an obese person? And we repeated these studies, which you can look up on PubMed several times. We do see an effect of beneficial effect of resolving diabetes for a couple of weeks, but not in everybody. And this busy slide, the only thing I'm asking you is look at the colors. We gave the same fecal donor three times to a patient with diabetes. And what we studied is how many bacteria are staying in the gut of that patient from the donor, or how many are kicked out. And orange means that the patient accepts these bacterial strains from the fecal stool preparation. And blue means that the patient kicks out all bacterial strains and keeps his own strains. Same donor, three different outcomes. And we have absolutely no idea why this is. So graphically, this is what it is. We have people that you transplant with stools in order to cut corners and treat them for a disease, and they respond. So they accept the graft, and others, they don't. And we know that we see this in cancer FMT, but also in inflammatory bowel disease. So we're going towards the end of the talk. Cyril Poulsoen and Wouter de Jonge showed that you can temporarily treat patients with inflammatory bowel disease with a donor stool. But once again, we have patients that respond in terms of quality of life and patients that do absolutely nothing. And we have no idea what this black box is. And this is exactly where we are. And this is why I would like to spark the discussion with you after the dinner, because we have a patient benefit and we have a safety issue, which we all have to take into account. Because we're not infusing only bacterial strains with this stool. We're infusing parasites, viruses that we have no idea of what they are, metabolites, and even human DNA. So my take, and now we're going to the practical end part, is that not all diseases are equally driven by bacteria, just like in animal farm. We have Clostridium, which is an overgrowth of a pathogen. You come in with healthy donor stool, you cure them. But if we go down in this pyramid of complexity towards autoimmune diseases like Professor Blaser's type 1 diabetes or Alzheimer's or anorexia, there these microbes are probably not causal. What they're doing is they, in a specific person, they drive the disease, and the other one, they just put them over the tipping point. So we have to understand that before we're going on with all of these fecal transplants, even though the side effects, at least in the Netherlands, were limited. It's even further, because an Israeli group showed that you could also transplant vaginal bacteria to women that have vaginosis, so an overgrowth of pathogens in their vagina. So it's not only fecal transplantation, we can do this for many other things. So, where are we? I think in the next 5 years, what we can do is we can basically say to a patient, give me your stool and I'll tell you what to eat. And I'll give you the example of that in the next slide. But it's going to take a long time before we can take this into therapy, because it takes time and we're basically in a black box here. So how to combat this? First is start with collaboration. And I'm very happy to show that at least at the AMC, we've combated this kind of approaches with teams, where we bring scientists together to say, okay, what is a normal stool and how to sequence a normal bacterial flora and give some reference values. Because once we know that, we can do a disease intervention trial, which I'm showing you here. Let's assume we have two people that eat a hamburger, but the people are not the same. Some person has a little bit more genes towards obesity, some other person has a little bit more towards, I don't know. And we give them the same diet, but this person digests this hamburger into metabolites and has bacteria that are not good for him. And others, this person digests it in a proper way and it's good for his body. We need to tease this out in order to bring this back to patients. And it's coming to patients, because I think Ellen de Visser is here in the audience. Every month there is a Volkskrant article about the role of the microbiota, not only in side effects, for example, of statins, giving muscle aches, but also that bacteria produce alcohol and have yourself a little brewery in your gut that can make you a little bit intoxicated by alcohol. It is all, I think, very fashionable, but not really therapeutic yet. So because we're going to have the last five slides, I would like to touch upon a topic which is a little bit controversial, which are probiotics. They're around for a long time. It's a $1 billion market. The Micropia made a publication about which probiotics, which you can sell over the buy over the counter, might alleviate symptoms in healthy subjects. But the controversial part is that these probiotics in disease patients can cause harm and even make you more sick. So in healthy subjects, okay, but in disease patients, maybe stay away from the probiotics until we know more about what these microbes are doing in the gut. So go back to Professor Blaser. Professor Blaser said, we have an issue where every generation we have lots of microbial strains. We have a problem in terms of to stabilize this loss, maybe bring it back. I've showed you that fecal transplant might be a way to cure this in a, well, old-fashioned, quite quick and dirty way. But the guy, the American surgeon who did the first fecal transplant in the world, he already stated 60 years ago that it's much better to go for strains, to pure strains that don't contain viruses or bacterial of a human DNA that might make us more sick. And that is, I think, the challenge. And if we solve that challenge, and if we can bring back strains that are missing in my gut or in Professor Blaser's gut in order to give us longevity, then I think the next step will be that we use these strains and empower them, for example, with genes that produce medication or genes that produce the missing hormones that we lack in our pancreas, in order to have not only take pills, but bacteria that produce the content of the pills that we have. And that will lead up to, I think, for my generation of doctors, a group of patients that we see in the outpatient clinic that to whom we can say, based on their microbiota, for you, probiotics might be the case. For you, we're not stay away from the hamburgers and take another diet. For you, nothing is going to happen. We're going to do a surgery to resolve your diabetes, and for others to give exercise and drug therapy. So I hope I've convinced you causality is still a long way in the human microbiome field, but it's promising. And these fecal transplants can help us to guide the way in treatment efficacy. They can help us also to cure patients now who died previously, like with the Clostridium infections, but are not a panacea. But the future, which I showed you in the example, will be that we can use this microbiome to say what kind of diet we should eat and how to empower our medicine. And I have to thank all the people in my group that did all the work. There's numerous people to thank, with Professor Blaser for the great collaborations we had, and I hope there will be many more in the future. I thank you.